bills today. The first one is House File 2890. Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's really an honor to be here today before you with this bill. This bill, as you will hear, is based on the SAGE program, model, that's the SAGE program, which we have in Minnesota. And as a nurse practitioner in my other world, I am proud to provide care for women through that program. Also, this bill deals with colon cancer, and I have a strong family history of colon cancer. My mother had it, my brother had it, and my grandmother had it. So it's really an honor to be here today. This year, we have been discussing ways to reform the healthcare system. We have talked about ways to improve quality, ways to expand access, and contain costs. And I think you'll agree by the end of the hearing that this bill gives us the opportunity to deal with all three of those things. Colorectal cancer is the third most common cancer. It is the second leading cause of cancer death in Minnesota. And Dr. Purdue will provide you with some of the statistics about that after I am done speaking. One, there are a couple things you should know about colorectal cancer. Everyone over the age of 50 is at risk for developing colon cancer, and it is not symptomatic until it reaches the advanced stage. Colon cancer can be prevented by early detection. In fact, it can be avoided with early detection. When polyps are found during the screening process and removed, colon cancer is completely avoided. That means that hundreds of cancer deaths each year could be avoided if everyone was able to get screened. Sorry about that. The cost of screening and removing polyps before they become cancerous is about $1,500 as compared to the cost of treating colorectal cancer, which is about $58,000. While even those with insurance coverage don't take full advantage of screening services, more than 80% of uninsured Minnesotans are at risk for developing colorectal cancer do not get screened. Lack of access is a major barrier, and this bill attempts to compensate for that gap. This is not a new government program. As I mentioned earlier, this is built on the success of a longstanding breast and cervical cancer prevention program, the SAGE program. That public-private partnership provides underinsured and uninsured women with access to private and community clinics for breast and cervical cancer screening services, and that would be extended to colorectal cancer screening services. By taking advantage of an existing program and infrastructure in the Minnesota Department of Health expertise, this bill would permit more resources to be used for direct services and less for administration. I've asked a representative from the Minnesota Department of Health to review how the SAGE program works, and that they will come up later on. It's important to note that this is not a new idea. The CDC has funded 5 demonstration projects, and at least 12 states have developed their own colorectal cancer screening programs. Let me stick to this now. I don't know if you guys can see that. briefly, to go through the bill, Section 1 directs the Commissioner of Health to implement a colorectal screening program. Section 2 delineates the eligibility, services, and treatment. Uninsured Minnesotans are those whose insurance does not cover colorectal screening, who are over 50 years of age or under 50 but at an increased risk, and whose incomes do not exceed 250% of federal poverty level would be eligible to participate. If a colon cancer diagnosis is made at screening, the patient would be enrolled in medical assistance to receive treatment. And Section 3, appropriate funding. A fiscal note is in process, and David Ahrens from the American Cancer Society will provide you with more information on that later. And with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Purdue.
Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself, if you could.
My name is David Purdue. I'm a gastroenterologist at the University of Minnesota. We're having some technical difficulties with the PowerPoint, but presenting without a PowerPoint presentation for last start. I'll give it my best shot. We do have a handout with the previous version.
And everybody, people have a handout, so.
So I'm a gastroenterologist. Maybe we can try to get this off. What's that? Sorry. Okay. I'm a gastroenterologist at the University of Minnesota. I spent half my time actually taking care of patients and seeing patients and engaging in colorectal cancer screening. The other half of my time I actually work on finding ways to get people to actually get screened for colon cancer. Colorectal cancer itself is actually the third most common type of cancer and the second leading cause of cancer-related death. And it actually affects about 2,600 Minnesotans a year. We have 2,600 individuals directly diagnosed with colon cancer. Per year, we have 1,000 who actually die from colorectal cancer. People are often surprised to hear that your lifetime risk of colorectal cancer is 1 in 17. 1 in 17 people get colorectal cancer in their life. Colorectal cancer is somewhat unique among cancers in that there is a we have a kind of an intermediate step between going from non-cancer to cancer, and that's this adenoma that's a polyp. And if you look at this third slide on your handout, you'll see a diagram that shows kind of a picture of a normal colon, a picture of a, what we call an adenomatous polyp, and these are just growths in the colon. And if you don't take those out, 1 in 10 of those will actually evolve into a colon cancer. If we take them out, again, we can prevent the disease. Now, when we're doing screening, we're trying to accomplish two things. We're trying to, A, find people who have cancer, and usually try to find them at earlier stages, but we're also trying to take these polyps out. And the prospective studies have shown that you can prevent up to 90% of colorectal cancer by taking these polyps out. This third slide is very important because what it shows is five-year survival from colorectal cancer. The slide right above it is kind of small and hard to see, but it shows the different staging for colon cancer. To the far left is the stage zero cancer, and these are actually cancer that's still inside a polyp. These are probably part of the most satisfying part of my job. As I go in, I'm doing a screening exam, I find a polyp that looks, you know, concerning, I take it out, I send it to the pathologist, and then the pathologist calls me back and says, you know what, there was cancer in that polyp, but it's all out. And I get to go home and call the patient at home and say, you know what, you had colon cancer, you had a 20-minute procedure, we took the polyp out, you don't have cancer anymore. So that's the power of screening. As you go down through the stages of cancer, stage 1 and 2 means the cancer is still in the bowel wall. Usually that's going to be treated with surgery, sometimes with some chemotherapy. Stage 3, it gets into the lymph nodes, and by stage 4, that cancer has actually gone other places in the body, and we have metastatic cancer. Unfortunately, most people who come in complaining of symptoms, you know, of colorectal cancer, they're having, you know, progressing constipation or blood in their stool. Unfortunately, usually it's taken to stage 4 cancer, and it's actually metastatic cancer. And going back to this 5-year survival rate, you'll see that if we catch cancer where it's in the bowel wall still, 9 out of 10 people are alive in 5 years. If it's gone to the lymph nodes, that drops to about 67% of people. And if you wait and people come in symptomatic with colon cancer, only 1 in 10 are actually alive after 5 years. It's really difficult to treat metastatic cancer. Risk factors for colon cancer, basically age, you know, it tends to affect people after age 50. That's when we start screening. Individuals with an increase with a family history are at increased risk. And then there are other risk factors. Diets, especially diets that are low in fiber, diets that are low in fresh fruits and vegetables, and diets that are high in animal fat increase your risk of colon cancer. Obesity is a known risk factor for colon cancer. Heavy smoking is a risk factor. And we've recently realized that diabetes actually increases your risk for colon cancer quite significantly. Turning the page, I think the, you know, theme for our campaign is that really colon cancer is a preventable disease. Early detection saves lives. Now, the most common ways to screen for colon cancer that are used in this country are a combination of fecal occult blood tests. That's a test where the patient takes home cards. They put stool on these cards, and from 3 subsequent stools, those are sent back and developed. And if they turn positive, it means there's blood in the stool. Doesn't necessarily mean they have cancer, but it means that they need to have a colonoscopy and look at the whole colon to see if there's something bleeding there. That is often combined, if those are negative, with a flexible sigmoidoscopy every 5 years, and that looks at the first half of the colon. If you look in the first half of the colon, you see a polyp, that patient has to have a full colonoscopy, both to get the polyps out, but also to look at the rest of the colon. Probably the gold standard for screening now is colonoscopy and doing that every 10 years in people who don't have polyps. Barium enema has remained on the recommendation list, mostly for patients who can't have colonoscopy because of their anatomy, they've had surgery, or they just won't tolerate it, or if it's unavailable to them. It's not used much for screening. Now, Minnesota actually leads the country in the proportion of our whole population that's been screened for colon cancer, and that's an exciting thing. Now, we're in the 60 to 70 percentile, meaning that 30 to 40% of our population hasn't been screened. It needs to be screened. So we have a lot of work to do there among insured individuals. If you look at uninsured individuals, however, less than 20% have any kind of colorectal cancer screening. They're the ones that are most likely to present to the emergency room. You know, they're bleeding or obstructed from a cancer, and they're the ones with the advanced stage cancers. And again, the cost of treating those cancers several years ago was in the $58,000 range, with the most recent medications that are extraordinarily expensive. We're pushing up to $100,000 to treat these cancers. What prevents people from getting cancer, or from getting actually screened for colorectal cancer, with a lot of barriers. Obviously, people are afraid. A lot of people live in denial, don't want to know they have cancer. Embarrassment's a piece of that. But of course, financial barriers are a major issue. Individuals often need to, you know, miss work to come get screened. They need a ride. They're worried that it's going to cost them a lot of money. And when we're working with our uninsured patients, oftentimes there are institutional barriers. Individuals are uncomfortable with medical systems. They have providers, when they do get seen, who aren't recommending these tests because they know they don't have resources. So who are Minnesota's uninsured? If you look at the health access survey that was done in 2005, there's approximately 41,000 individuals between the ages of 50 and 64 who are uninsured. And we focus on this age range because for average risk screening, we start that at age 50. And then at 65, Medicare actually pays for colonoscopy screening. So we're really targeting this kind of in-between where we have an opportunity to actually prevent the disease and not just make diagnoses. If you look at the uninsured, actually in Minnesota, 78% are white, 10% are Hispanic, 10% are African American, and about 4% are American Indian. Obviously, colon cancer affects different races differently. It is significantly higher in American Indians. It is also higher in African Americans and Latinos than it is in the white race in general. And if you look at that next slide, it does show the uninsurance rate among different race groups. About 4% of whites are uninsured, about 9% of blacks, 6% of American Indians, and 9% of Hispanics and Latinos. Contrary to common belief, over 85% of our uninsured are actually born in the United States, so it's not really an immigrant issue. Cancer mortality, I said before, does vary by race, and so it's an important thing to think about. The last minute of my presentation, I just want to talk about an actual pilot program that has been a joint venture between Minnesota Gastroenterology, which is a group of 45 gastroenterologists here in Minneapolis, the largest private practice group in the country, Colorectal Surgery Associates, which is a large colorectal surgery group, and in conjunction have worked closely with the Minnesota Colorectal Cancer Task Force, which is part of the Minnesota Minnesota Cancer Alliance. And the Minnesota Department of Health. And the concept here was to, if we had a free screening day, and we brought in gastroenterologists, and we recruited women from this breast and cervical program for free screening, would they come? Would they be interested? And would they participate? And how would it go? What would we learn from that situation? We've had two screening events. We've had women calling and calling and calling and begging to get on the list. We can only take, again, 20 per weekend. We had 43 women who were scheduled. 41 actually showed up and got screened. I think one or two canceled the day before, and one was not prepped well enough to have screened. And 15 of those individuals were actually high risk by definition. They had family members or they had polyps taken out back when they were insured. Of those individuals, 15 out of 41 actually had polyps. 12 of those were adenomas, and 2 were actually what we call advanced adenomas, and those that have very high risk for turning into colorectal cancer within 2 years. So this is a very successful pilot program. And with that, I would like to pass on to our next speaker.
Are there any questions at all? Representative Boffer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to our guests, one of the things that I was surprised to learn this summer was that
insurance companies in evaluating people over age 50 for individual policies. If they haven't had a colonoscopy, sometimes we'll reject them just because of the cost of the procedure versus what they might get in premiums. But at least that's something that they weigh in making those decisions, which I thought was surprising. And I just think prevention really works. Thank you.
Representative Ruth.
I neglected to mention that Representative Carol McFarland is actually a co-sponsor of this bill, co-author, and I invited her to sit down here, but she needs to buzz out for a meeting, so I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Right.
If there are no further questions, would you have another testifier?
Yes.
Cindy Hilger is a cancer survivor and has been kind enough to come down here today. And many of you remember Cindy when she worked at WCCO, and we all... I told her she's like a movie star to me. So.
Really old one.
She was her son, too, who is who had a tour of the Capitol.
Yes, we've been away. Thank you. Very, very happy to be here and speak before this. And I want to thank you for co-sponsoring this bill as well. It's very important, and it means a lot to me. I did bring my son with. We've been in Arizona for the last 5 years, and he's toured the Arizona Capitol numerous times. He's never been to the Minnesota Capitol, and I thought we'd take advantage of this opportunity and then give him the tour. I came back from the Dune City 7 or 8 months ago, and I wanted to volunteer some time. And the
If you could just identify yourself for this.
Oh, I'm sorry. Cindy Hilger, H-I-L-L-G-E-R, colon cancer survivor. I contacted the American Cancer Society and said, you know, I'd love to be able to offer my services. If there's any campaigns, anything that I could work on with you, I'd be happy to. And they said, well, we're launching a colon cancer campaign at the Capitol this year. And I said, well, I've had colon cancer and I've survived it. And they said, well, would you be willing to testify and talk about your experience? And I said I would be glad to. And so here we are this morning. I wanted to just give you a glimpse into what it means to get the diagnosis and what it means to be treated with colon cancer, and also what it means to survive this disease. 11 years ago, my husband had just been transferred to Los Angeles. He was running the CBS affiliate out there. And less than a week into our time in L.A., we were attending an event, and I was bending down to put a shoe on, and I couldn't stand up. And I just had severe pain in my lower abdomen, didn't know what it was. I had never been sick a day in my life. So I was rushed to Cedar Sinai, and they took out my appendix. And I came home, and I still couldn't stand up. And I went through a series of tests and was diagnosed with everything from diverticulitis, Crohn's disease, irritable bowel syndrome, and my favorite, when they couldn't come up with anything else, they said, well, you just have a bad case of hemorrhoids, and sent me home. And finally, we did a surgery, and they discovered a tumor the size of a golf ball lodged in an area in my colon that provided a symptom. Now, it had broken through the wall of the colon and was not in the lymph nodes, and so I dodged a bullet there. But because of my age, I was only 38, and I had an 11-month-old who's sitting behind me right now, who's now 11 years old, and a 4-year-old at the time, they decided to do a full year of chemotherapy with me. So every week, every Wednesday morning, I moved back here just to have a support system. My whole family's from here. In fact, Maria's mother-in-law and my mom taught together in Bloomington Public Schools, which we just discovered today, and did a year regimen of chemotherapy. And went through the first half year fine. The second half year, though, it really did start to take its toll. The obvious hair loss, my skin and veins and everything and dried up. And finally, after 45 treatments, I couldn't take it anymore, and I became, I guess, for lack of a better word, poisoned with it. And so I wound up in the hospital, and thank God I've been cancer-free ever since. But the treatment, the surgeries, all the screenings that I did prior to the diagnosis totaled close to $150,000. And obviously, I'm very grateful to be here, but I would not wish this upon anybody. And so a screening that would cost $1,200 versus the year of what our family went through, and fortunately I had wonderful insurance, and so our out-of-pocket wasn't that great, but it was an awful, awful expense. And I wanted you to understand a few things about colon cancer. There is no self-exam for this disease. This is something I didn't know I had polyps. I had no idea. You can't see them. You can't feel them. And oftentimes, you don't know you have cancer until, as Dr. Perdue said, it is too late. Colon cancer is a very random kind of a cancer, and many cancers have stronger links to behavior and lifestyle, and while there are some links with colon cancer, they're not as great as, for example, lung cancer. And most often, cancers do begin as polyps, and it takes a long time for those polyps to grow into cancer. In fact, in my case, they said it could have been up to 15 years. But unless there's a screening, you don't know they're there. But finding these polyps is a surefire way to prevent this disease. And the only way you can find them is through screening. So I hope you think about what we're talking about here today. I'm here because I truly wish I had an angel on my shoulder. And I've been able to return to a normal life, to watch my children grow up, and be here with me today. And I'd ask you to give others the same chance, because this is a disease that if doctors can find it and detect it, they can treat this disease, and I'm living, breathing proof that you can survive this disease. So I would ask for your help and your recognition of this bill. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. David Aaron. He is the Director of Government Relations at the American Cancer Society, Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, just so we have that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Ahrens, Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society in Minnesota. And on behalf of the American Cancer Society, we're the largest volunteer organization in Minnesota and in the United States that's devoted to the elimination of cancer. And it is really a great honor to appear before this committee, and especially after the kind of debate that this committee and this body has been through in the last few weeks on health care reform. ACS applauds your work as a committee to address the need for high-quality, affordable health care through comprehensive legislation that's now passed the House. And we very much thank this committee and the work of the members for their work on health care reform. But like so many, and probably many in this room, we don't know the final outcome of this session's legislative process on health care reform. So we look forward at this time, and today is a very important day because this committee that determines the health policy for the state has a chance to learn and hopefully endorse a strategy to solve a major problem, a major health care problem, which is colon cancer, the second leading cause of death from cancer in Minnesota. Just a few minutes ago, Dr. Perdue conveyed the problem. Close to 1,000 Minnesotans each year die from colon cancer. Many more have potentially cancerous polyps. Their deaths come from the kind of immense suffering that Cindy Hilger survived, and after patients and providers have spent many thousands of dollars on treatment for late-stage cancer. But we bring to you a solution. Provide screening. It saves lives and costs. As Dr. Perdue said, when colorectal cancer is detected early, 90% of patients survive 5 years. When it goes undetected and metastasizes, a word that I'm still trying to pronounce each day, the 5-year survival rates drop to 10%. And as he said, there's an array of different colorectal cancer screening tests, but one of them, the colonoscopy, is a test that detects and removes potentially cancerous polyps and costs approximately $1,100 for a test that's generally needed once every 10 years. Now, compare this cost to the per-patient cost of late-stage colorectal cancer, which may be as high as $60,000 to $100,000 or even more. So one test can really save a lot of money as well as a life. Now, the bill authored by Representative Rood and its companion authored by Senator Sharon would save lives and costs by providing an opportunity for Minnesotans who would otherwise lack access to care. The American Cancer Society endorses Representative Rood's bill because we have a healthcare system that provides all Minnesotans, because until we have a healthcare system that provides all Minnesotans access to cancer screening and prevention services, we need to create a special opportunity for economically at-risk Minnesotans to get life-saving screenings. Here's the good news. If Minnesota invests in the creation of this public-private partnership built upon an existing model of cancer prevention, it can begin saving lives and over time save costs to patients, our healthcare system, and Medicare. In a moment, the Department of Health is going to share with you information about Minnesota's breast and cervical cancer program, that's existed since 1991, this AIDS program, and how it may serve to aid in the creation of a complementary colorectal cancer screening initiative. Colorectal cancer, as you know, is needed and saves lives. But the question remains, why launch a public-private program, a public-private partnership now, at this time? Well, number one is the free screening days that Dr. Perdue described are critically important, and they tell us a very important piece of information. If we build it, they will come. People do come out to the free screening days, but free screening days are not enough. We need an opportunity that's consistent and open to those who are under and uninsured. Now, there's a couple advantages of doing this initiative now. One is, here's some magic words, potential federal matching funds if federal legislation is enacted. At the federal level, H.R. 1738 would allow the Centers for Disease and Control and Prevention to make grants to states to carry out colorectal screening programs. If Minnesota already has its own program, then Minnesota would probably be more likely to receive federal matching dollars from the federal government. So getting one in place makes us riper to receive those critical, potentially 3-to-1, 4-to-1 matching dollars. Second, we have proven models to build upon. We're not inventing something from scratch. At least 12 other states have colorectal screening programs, including Maryland, New York, and Colorado. And then some, for us, very compelling cost information. Dr. Tim Byers, head of the Colorado Screening Program, estimates that the $1 million state investment yields approximately $4 million in medical costs in terms of savings to patients. It pays dividends to do this kind of screening. The Centers for Disease and Control and Prevention recently funded a demonstration program to test the feasibility of providing community-based colorectal screening. The program analysis concluded that four factors facilitated program startup. We stack up very well on all four of the key things the CDC says you need to have. Number one, they said the most important factor to launching a successful program is having a pre-existing program infrastructure. In Minnesota, we already have some of the needed infrastructure through the SAGE program. Number two, partnerships. CDC says partnerships matter to creating these programs and making them work. The American Cancer Society is a long-standing partner to the Department of Health as it implements the SAGE program. We provide soft match contributions of community education and outreach programs that make potentially eligible Minnesotans aware of the SAGE program and connect them to staff who get them to community-based clinics for screening. ACS wants to extend its partnership to end with MDH to help create a pipeline of potential enrollees in a colorectal cancer screening program. ACS does not receive any state funding for this work, nor does it want or expect to receive funding through the proposed colorectal cancer screening partnership. The number three critical factor indicated by the CDC for this to work is clinical expertise. This bill and this proposal has the opportunity to tap into the Minnesota Cancer Alliance, a consortium of over 70 leading healthcare institutions, including health partners, alliance facilities and others, and associations around the state that in turn offer a tremendous amount of expertise to lend to the creation of this partnership. Moreover, Minnesota has many of the nation's leading gastroenterologists and oncologists that want to end late-stage colorectal cancer because they know it can be prevented. Good news is we're in the right state to do this. If we were in some other states, which I'm not going to name publicly, we wouldn't be in such good shape. We're in a great state to tackle colorectal cancer. Number four, program champions. CDC has said you need program champions to get this done, and this is a critical success factor. And that's where we ask you to come in. We ask you to be among the program champions for this. So far, in talking with us about members of the legislature and the executive branch, we can't find someone that's against this program. Everyone agrees it needs to be done, and it's worthwhile. The American Cancer Society asks your support next session because we ask for something that will pay off, solve a big problem, advance Minnesota's own goals for addressing health disparities, and provide access to care. This bill represents an opportunity to place a solution that fits the goals of both the Legislative Commission on Healthcare Access, the Governor's Task Force, and the Minnesota Cancer Plan. Obviously, this is not a partisan issue, This is simply an issue of priorities, and ECF believes this bill represents an opportunity to prevent a leading killer of Minnesotans with a surefire, clinically proven through screening, and delivers this solution that builds upon expertise, infrastructure, committed partnership, and the leadership right here. We thank you very, very much for letting us testify today and bring this problem to you so we can work together to tackle Minnesota's second leading cause of cancer death and fight Minnesota's number one leading cause of death overall, which is cancer. Thank you very much.
Either Mr. Ahrens or Representative Root, do we know of the people that would be screened, or even under the, maybe the SAGE program, folks can answer this too, if people who aren't screened, kind of the non-prevented cancer patients, how many are in, who pays for the cancer treatment for those folks? Is that publicly covered?
If
they're not picked up in the screening and then if they find out they have cancer and have to go through the expensive treatment, do we know who covers?
The answer back here is Hennepin County Medical Center or wherever they present.
Yeah, someone could just.
And we're going to defer some of these program and questions about the nitty gritty with to the Department of Health.
Sure, no, that's.
You know, that's just commonly the case with uninsured individuals. Usually, again, they're not seeking out preventative care. They usually wait till they get pretty sick. I did a colonoscopy yesterday on a woman who's been having rectal bleeding for a year and a half. And she just was hoping it'd go away, hoping it'd go away. She was able to get signed up with Medicaid. She's under 50 and get into see us. But most of these individuals are going to present to the emergency rooms and oftentimes get admitted to the hospital. And the social workers start doing their best to see what types of state benefits or state programs they can get them enrolled in for care. A lot of times the hospitals are going to, you know, write this off as charity care. So it really depends on the individual's resources, where they qualify, means tests, et cetera. But it really falls back to us.
Okay.
Society pays for those individuals.
No, I'm
in multiple ways.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I'm trying to figure out if we can find some savings from the investment here. So. Okay. All right.
I have one more question for you.
Yes.
I'm sure, if that's okay.
Sure.
Mr. Slater from the department. Oh.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself just for the tape.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Jonathan Slater. I'm Chief of the Cancer Control Section at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I've been asked to describe the SAGE program in part because it's envisioned that the colorectal cancer screening program would be modeled on SAGE and perhaps achieve some of the efficiencies by being a parallel program. So let me briefly describe both how SAGE works and what it's accomplished, and feel free to interrupt me as I'm going along. I'm not sure what the questions are that might have come up in previous testimony. SAGE is a free breast and cervical cancer screening program that provides services through a network of over 370 clinics around the state. I know one of the issues that had come up before was that this is predominantly in the metro area. You have a folder that has a few pieces of paper in there, and one of them is a map, which is not very exact, but about half of the clinics are in the metro area and half of them are not. The program was established in 1991 when Minnesota was one of the first four states that successfully competed for a federal grant to provide the discrete program. It was subsequently funded in 1998 through a bill sponsored in the House through, by Representative Otremba to support the program as actually federal funds started to contract. And in addition, we've had funding from the Komen Foundation, which varies from year to year. Komen is the parent organization of Race for the Cure, which probably everybody's heard about by now. They give us this year $900,000, and it pays for diagnostic services and screening for women who are not otherwise eligible for our program. The services are provided through a wide range of medical models. It's everything from the Mayo Clinic and HCMC and other large urban medical centers to individual doctors' offices in rural settings to local public health and everything in between. To be eligible for SAGE, it's similar criteria to what you may have heard about the projected eligibility criteria for a colorectal program. Women have to be at or below 250% of the poverty level. And to make that real to most people who are not familiar with what the FPL stands for, it's both a function of income and household size. So if a woman makes $226,000 and has no dependents in her household or the household is just her, she would be eligible for the program. That would be at the cap. With one other person in the household, that would be $35,000 a year. It's basically people who are making 2 to 2.5% of the minimum wage. They also have to either have no health insurance, have health insurance that doesn't cover cancer screening, or have co-pays or deductibles that are not going to be met. I'll go into more details about the program in a moment, but so that you have more of a understand the value of the program, since 1991, when we screened 2 patients in the first year, we are now we're projecting to screen for this year 19,000 women. We screened 110,000 women, unique women, overall, provided over 250,000 screening tests. And most importantly, we've detected and treated more than 1,300 women with breast or cervical cancer, predominantly breast cancer. In addition, and analogous to finding a polyp in colorectal cancer, we've detected and treated more than 2,700 precancerous cervical lesions. These are moderate or severe dysplasia that would otherwise progress to invasive cervical cancer. Another take on the same information, and what I think is a rather remarkable statistic, for every 128 women that we screen in SAGE, we find a new case of cancer. Most of the time, not all of the time, but most of the time, this translates into a life saved. Minnesota's SAGE program is the pair of last resort. There are often questions about what if people have other forms of health insurance. Because we're the payer of last resort, if women have other forms of health insurance, they pay first, whether that's public or private health insurance. We get the EOB, which is essentially the insurance form, and after everybody else has paid, if there's a residual cost and they're otherwise qualified, we pay the balance. So the net story for the woman is that there's no cost to her. There's in your folder, there's a mailing, and I'm bringing that to your attention because for a subgroup of women, they're desperate to get health services through our program, and as we've heard in the colorectal program, for a subset of people, they're basically knocking down the door to get into the program. There's another subset of women, which is substantial, which require persuasion to come into the program. And the materials that you see in front of you are part of what SAGE does to recruit women into screening. Screening tests are always noxious, unfortunately, and that's the truth of it. And screening treatment, or treatment after a positive test, is something that everybody wants to avoid. So there's a lot to overcome. And a lot of what this program does is help people, not overcoming the cost barriers, which is substantial and is the difference between this and sort of the usual healthcare system, but also trying to persuade those people who are reluctant to come in, which is actually the majority of Americans, to go ahead and come in. A question came up about treatment. I don't know if this program would model what's been done for breast and cervical. In the breast and cervical program, treatment is paid for through something called MADC. And I tried to find out what that stands for. In fact, I can't find out what it stands for. I would think it might be the Medicaid Breast Cancer Act, but it also pays for cervical cancer, so it doesn't quite map on. But at the end of the day, for women who have no health insurance, it pays the cost of treatment, and it's a federal state shared program, just as Medicaid is. For women who have any health insurance, unfortunately, it doesn't cover anything. So even if a woman has a catastrophic policy with a $20,000 copay, deductible, she would be 100% uncovered. And I think that's a gap in the current plan. How this would map onto the colorectal cancer program hasn't really been discussed. I'm not sure that there's an equivalent opportunity with a federal match in Medicaid. Another key element is...
Can I just interrupt?
Please.
So the MABC, under your program, you qualify for up to people under 250% of the poverty guidelines, but MA, so MA for that particular kind of treatment goes beyond the typical, what is it, 100?
Yes. It's 100, a carve
150,
out.
Okay.
It's an exception in the same way that we have for people with end-stage renal disease. There's a carve out in Medicare to cover them. It's a carve out in Medicaid.
Thank you.
Sure. We also track every patient who is screened through SAGE to assure that she gets appropriate follow-up and treatment. This is especially true, especially essential in this population. We're talking almost by definition of a population that does not have a usual source of care. By not having a usual source of care, it's easy for somebody to see a primary care doctor, get referred to a gastroenterologist or an oncologist, and things not track the way it should if you're really integrated into a healthcare system. And in fact, a lot of our efforts going into tracking these patients, assuring that they get appropriate follow-up, the women who refuse treatment, not even knowing that they're eligible to have treatment covered. And we actually have a large computerized system that tracks all patients, but then social workers will go out and work with these underserved populations to try to get them matched up with treatment services. And maybe I should at least stop or pause there in case there are questions and try to rest through them.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm looking at the screening sites handout that's in the folder, and I think it's really impressive, the penetration of screening sites for the existing program, and I'm wondering if you can tell me how that was developed and how long it took and what you would envision then for developing something like that for the colorectal screening.
I'm not sure what it's called. It's not a fiscal note, but the precursor to the fiscal note, which gave an estimate for the cost that I saw for the Senate. The costs were much lower for the first year, and that's because it takes a while to build this. There are advantages to there already being a SAGE program in that we have relationships with almost 400 clinics around the state. But although there's a huge role for the primary care doctor, there are others providing endoscopy with the colonoscopy with whom we don't have a relationship other than through the Cancer Alliance. And that's a metro-based thing. So the way I would imagine it is in the first year, we would spend a lot of time negotiating relationships with these providers. This is not going to be a cost-making opportunity for the healthcare system. So there's actually a fair amount of negotiations that have to take place. We've capped our reimbursement rates at the Medicare rate, and I imagine we would do the same thing for colorectal cancer. I would expect that within the first year we'd have working partnerships with 20 to 30 clinics, maybe 2 to 3 times that at the end of the second year. And then the word gets out, and then people are coming to you. So I would imagine that in terms of primary care clinics, we would be in virtually the same clinics that we're in now as it relates to endoscopists, which are the specialists. There's actually a limited number of providers, and we would be starting on day one to try to get all of them to sign up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Slater. It is impressive what you've been able to put together. The 46% that have insurance, could you give us a kind of, if you have the information, sort of a snapshot? Are those mostly people who are on Medicare? They're mostly people in high deductible plans? If we had, it's intriguing to me that it's that high a percentage who actually do have some kind of insurance coverage.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a complete array of possibilities. Predominantly, we have women who are in Medicare who don't have any supplements, who have out-of-pocket expenses and wouldn't get screened, which is something that was believed not to have been a barrier to screening because mammograms are free. The office visit isn't free. So we even have women who have sort of the best health insurance system in the country with Medicare eligible for a program. People who have Medicaid typically are not in our program because that should cover 100%, but we enroll them because Medicaid, I may have misspoken, but Medicaid is a system where people go on and off over the course of a year. And when they call us, they might be on. By the time they're due, they may be off. So we enroll them. We bill Medicaid. If they're no longer enrolled in Medicaid, we pay. If they're enrolled in Medicaid, we don't. There are many people who have catastrophic health insurance policies, and especially for women in rural Minnesota, there's a lot of catastrophic and in the true meaning of a catastrophic policy, $15,000-$20,000 deductibles that functionally are uninsured not only for screening but for most of treatment. And that represents a not insubstantial proportion of the women we serve. You'd actually find out more details about that if you'd like. There are times when the out-of-pocket expenses that are spared are small, but it actually, that small amount keeps women from coming in. There are times when the out-of-pocket expenses, even for women who are insured, are substantial.
So that information would actually be helpful.
Sure.
So thank you.
Happy to provide it.
Other questions? Okay, did you have additional information? Okay.
Chair members and members, just to reflect upon the work we've done in committee this year, and again, looking for ways to reform the system and to focus more on prevention and things like early detection. It's not just, you know, makes economic sense. It's the right thing to do. So I hope we can seriously consider this bill next year. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Ms. Rood. Okay. I saw Representative Emmer was actually reviewing the minutes. Would you move those minutes?
So moved.
All right, any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Maybe it's something else
to move when you get more votes. No. All right. The next bill on the agenda today to talk about is House File 2640. Representative Otremba.
Good morning. As the chair has said, this is the pregnant women and parents support bill. Now, I'll just kind of give you a little overview, and then we'll have Patty. Where did she go? And then we'll go on with the testifiers.
Wonderful.
First of all, for those of us sitting at the table, we look at this as an option to carry the child to term, to be able to do that when they would like to have that done. And so part of the bill is prohibiting policy waiting prenatal and maternity care, eliminating pregnancy as a pre-existing condition, establishing a parent support grant program, informational hotline on available pregnancy, adoption, parental agencies, adoption referral information, parenting counseling, tax credit for adoption, and bake sales to get this done. I guess there's no money. So that's just kind of an overview, but Pat Mullins would be my first testifier.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Mullins. Please identify yourself for the record, if you would.
I'm Pat Mullins. I'm Executive Director with Democrats for Life of Minnesota, and thank you for having me here this morning. The bill specifically looks to eliminate the stumbling blocks a woman with an unplanned pregnancy finds should she choose to carry the child to term. So it's kind of a different spin on things, and in that the majority of the abortions statistically are chosen out of economic concerns, it makes sense that we address these issues. And that's what this bill has done and what Representative Otremba has put together. It runs through, we have the handout, Section 1 and 2, the eliminating pregnancy as a pre-existing condition in individual health insurance coverage for pregnant women. This section would ensure that pregnant women will receive prenatal and postnatal care by eliminating pregnancy as a pre-existing condition in the individual health care market and also eliminate waiting periods for women with prior coverage. There's background data provided as well. There are a great many loopholes for the insurance industry. There are guidelines that have been set up back in 1996 with HIPAA. However, there are ways around that, and they're actively pursued. This part of the bill would eliminate those loopholes and, again, give the woman a better choice. The parenting support grant from Section 7 support services for pregnant and parenting skills at post-secondary educational institutions. This is very important. You talk to folks, and if you have a woman that finds herself pregnant in her freshman, sophomore, doesn't matter, year in college, she's given the choice quite often of continuing her education, which she's probably been planning all of her life, and she's in the middle of, or having this child. And quite often, the middle way is not seen as an option. And what we want to do here is present that middle way as an option, to have daycare provided on campus to make it possible to make that choice to carry the child to term. So that would be that section. The Section 8 Public Awareness Hotline campaign. This is pretty easy. There are some access over the internet to this information, but not everyone has access. And since the people that we're hoping to help here are primarily folks that are economically disadvantaged, this would open up an avenue for them. It's the establishment of a toll-free statewide telephone number to increase public awareness of resources available to assist pregnant women carrying their pregnancies to term and to assist new parents. Again, we hear over and over again, I didn't know I had any options. I didn't know I had any choices. Well, this is providing that.
Reverend Donald. Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, I'm aware that there are a lot of agencies, private sector agencies, that do a lot of promotion. I can certainly think of several in our district who deal with numerous services for women who are pregnant, Birthline and others like that, that try to support women in this situation and do a great job of publicly promoting that. Is this trying to do the same thing?
It's expanding on
Mr. Mullen.
It's expanding on it. This is a toll-free number that encompasses everything. So it's not replacing what's in place. It's complementing what's in place. Expanding is just a little bit.
So, Mr. Mullen, as I understand it, we already have, it's basically a place you would call, and then they would refer you to the organizations Representative Gottwald is talking about. Is that, Mr. Mullen, or Representative Gottwald, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, again, my sense is we already have some of this stuff in place. I don't know that we've got hotlines for exactly these sorts of things already in place, and I'm concerned that this becomes duplicative or another layer.
Well, the research done prior to writing the bill, Representative, was that that was not in fact the case. That there were several, but there was not a general, an overall. We look at the NCCL bill to see if these things were included. They were not. So again, it's certainly on the same vein, but from the research that was done, we found that this was not specifically available.
Mr. Chair,
President,
in fact, there was a bill in 1998. I actually was the chief author, and that bill, the women that were having abortions had to fill out this form, and in this form, year after year after year, the same things that we're talking about now are still, so obviously they are still not knowing that they have options. And so I think it's better to have those options to everybody and not, I think the more we have, the more we'll be able to help, quite frankly. Because obviously it's still happening, because that survey that comes out every year still talks about housing and all of those things. So this is just another avenue to prevent abortion.
Bella. Mr. Chair and to the testifier, again, I'm a little confused because on page 4 of this bill, there's reference to what we already have, that we have a hotline, 24-hour-a-day phone number. I'm looking at line 426 and 427. This toll-free 24-hour-a-day telephone number that may be called to obtain earlier by a tape-recorded message information about this, my understanding is this already exists in state law. The Department of Health already is required to have this in place. So this is my genuine concern. I'm not interested in destroying the idea, the concept, but I'm concerned about the duplication because my understanding is the state already has this.
Well, were that
Mr. Mullen,
that certainly would be something we would be happy to alter. We certainly don't look to duplicate for any reason, certainly not for added cost. So, yes, sir.
President Finstead?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to point out the same that I believe that was in the original Women's Rights and Old Bill we passed a few years ago. It's in Section 8, and I know Representative Tremble worked hard for that for that bill. So I appreciate emphasizing the fact that this is out there and it's a good thing. I do want to point out, and I don't want to be political, I'm sincere by this, but this bill addresses a lot of great things. I want to point out, and maybe I can get the help of the chair of Democrats for Life, because I find ironic in the last 2 years the Democrats have proposed to cut positive alternatives funding. And I will acknowledge that in the House we were able to get that money back at the last minute, but I know it's something we've had to fight to get back the last 2 years. So Representative Otremba has been a big help, and I would ask the Democrats for Life group to help us with that, too, to make sure that program stays intact and strong.
And, Mr. Chair, there are a number of, well, the society polls that are out there show that almost 50% of the Democrats nationally are pro-life. So we're working as much as we can, and I think we do a pretty good job.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, and Representative Finstead. I remember when we got the funding for positive alternatives, and I still have some concerns personally, not because of who brought the money forward, but some of the programming that some of the sites are having. I just wanted to make sure that we remind members that most of us are on Health and Human Service Finance. However, the budget to that has none of our members have had the opportunity to decide on how that is funding is going to be cut or appropriated. It is the Housing and Public Health Committee that has their own set of members and their own sets of priorities that move things forward. So to just say Democrats, remember we're Health and Human Services and we have our own priorities too.
Nothing rude. Did you?
Sure. Okay. Well,
you don't have to.
I would like to just kind of say something in response to Representative Finstead. The Positive Alternatives Act, I think it did receive bipartisan support, if I remember correctly, when it left the House. But I actually was contacting them, and I wanted to know where did the money go, and could you tell me, be accountable, I guess. Well, we asked other programs to do that, too. And the response I received was really they couldn't. And I'm still waiting for that response because they don't keep that information. So while I do know now where the money went, I guess it's still unclear what we got for our money. Does that make sense? And so it's not to criticize the program overall, but I think that would be something that would be helpful for us as a body when we do have to make budget cuts to know that we're getting a good bargain for our money.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate those comments, and I look forward to that same exact speech on a lot of things that we do around here. I will tell you, and I could forward on some emails to you from mothers and families that have written me thanking me for being the chief author of that bill saying, because of the money and the help the Crisis Birthing Center provided us, we now have a baby. And if it's one time, or if it's 50 times, it's money well spent. We've saved a life.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, last year the funding was severely cut in the Housing Committee, and I funded it out of my budget last year. And I'm a strong supporter of that program, and there's a very active and very good program in the city of Duluth that uses some of that money and does a great job with these women.
Reverend Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that under the Positive Alternatives Program, the state has, and the Department of Health is here, and maybe they could speak to this, that my understanding is they had more requests for grants than they had money to fill. So my understanding is there's been tremendous utilization of this particular program. And I would simply add that I think Representative Ruud's absolutely right. There are a lot of programs, frankly, that we spend a lot of money on that it would be good to know where that money is going. But that's my understanding, and perhaps the Department of Health can say more about that, but that they actually have more requests for grants than they have money for.
Well, and Mr. Chair,
Representative Tremba,
we know that we have the cap right now with NSETS, and we know that the abortions are going down, but obviously the people on MSEP are having the abortions, and I think that's gone up 29%. And so somewhere in that piece, those mothers do not know that there's an option, or because the money isn't there, that's an economic piece. And so I think this is part of the bill, quite frankly, that actually saves babies, as you said.
Part of the budget bill.
Yes.
Yeah. Representative Stinstead, and then we'll move on. From
thank you, Mr. And I do want to make sure that I want to make this clear. I do appreciate Representative Huntley and Representative Keith for what you've done to get this back. You know, I acknowledge that the blame lies in a different committee, and I see how that all works, and I do know where it came back. I will say that it's probably because of your tenacity to get it back, and that you have seen a program in your area that works, that we were able to get the funding back. I realize the Senate probably wasn't overly interested in doing it, so I know the fights that you've had to fight, and I appreciate that. I made that clear.
Okay. Back to the bill. I think we're on the Section 9, then. Is that?
Yes. The purpose is the patients receiving positive test diagnoses for Down syndrome or other prenatally diagnosed conditions. This part of the bill, you've got, as it stands right now, you've got, 80% of the babies diagnosed with Down syndrome and 95% of the babies diagnosed with cystic fibrosis are aborted. And the test to diagnose these are prone to error. And this is written into the bill as, once again, an informational item for the woman to have to make her choice. You've got a number of contradicting data quite often. When you've got a false positive of up to, oh goodness, some reports up to 80%. And some of the folks to talk to within the, as I understand it, if a woman has the test, if she asks what the chances are of a false positive, she'll be given a variety of information. However, if she does not ask, she will not be given that information. They put it at a 5%, but there are a variety of other factors involved. And what this includes is that the woman be supplied with all of this information rather than just a little bit. And it's not swayed one way or the other. It's simply good, solid information to base a decision on. And that's why that was included.
Representative Ruud.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just to so members know, that the screening test, which is often referred to actually as the AFP test or a quad screen or triple screen, where it depends where you are in your pregnancy, is a screening test. It's not a diagnostic test. So if a woman does have a test result that is abnormal, I can't think of any physician that would make a diagnosis based on that screening test. That woman would be offered an amniocentesis, which is considered a diagnostic test. So I just want to let the record to reflect there are false positives with this test result. We do tell women about that when we are offering that to them in the clinic, and we actually do hand them the brochure, but I just want the record to be correct.
Section 10, if I may, counseling requirements, very straightforward. Requires an organization, agency, clinic, or health care center which receives state funds to provide pregnancy or family planning services to also provide adoption referral information. Very straightforward. Once again, it's just about adding to the information available. Adoption and parenting counseling, section 11, if I may. That they supply these as well. And in order for them to make an informed decision, that they be given all the facts.
And what specifically is contemplated in that provision? How would someone comply with that provision? Oh, this is from Eternity Group Home.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And can you talk just a little bit more about that, what the maternity group home is? And
well, I know there are some in my community where the we have homes for the handicapped, and they have homes for moms so that they have a place to live until they can get out of the system, so to speak. And so they're relatively new, I think, but they have been very successful.
Where's McDowell?
Mr. Chair, one of the questions I had, maybe it's along the same lines you were asking too, is this is a two-sentence provision in the bill. I like the idea of getting parenting skills in this sort of situation. We need to build capacity in people to do a better job in that area in these situations. But there's very little specificity here about what those parenting skills are, how they're going to be delivered. Does this refer back to another set of services that would fall under parenting skills, or is this kind of left very open-ended?
Well, Mr. Chair, parenting skills can be as little as a counseling session to having a degree and actually getting parent education. So there's and usually, I never lived in one, but they do a good job teaching parents how to be parents, and that's, I don't know what else to say. I mean, they're going to use programs, I'm assuming, that will work. I have a parent ed licensure, so I have worked in that area. And you work with the moms, and you work with the dads, and you work with the kids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Latrem, but like I said, I think this is a great thing, but I think if we want to really have it accomplished and not just kind of say we're going to do it, we probably need some more specificity here, and that might be something you might want to work on as this bill comes forward, to say what's going to be delivered that's going to deliver parenting skills to these people.
Mr. Chair, that's why we are having this type of committee meeting instead of this is an informational, and so it's pieces that you can bring back to me to rewrite. Representative Vincent sits on my committee, and he knows how we do that. We actually work them out and then come back and redo it. And so this is why we're here. And it's informational, and you all have an input, and so this can be better. I'm certainly not going to disrespect anybody in this committee for what we're doing.
Can I just come back to this maternity group home? And I maybe should know this, but so you've mentioned something about people with disabilities who live in group homes. But are these a separate home for young moms or something? Is that,
Mr. Chair? Yes, they have. They usually have several sort of apartment sorts of things, and they are trained to be moms or dads. And it's a safe place, because a lot of times they're in that position too. They're relatively new, but I've been really encouraged by that, because we've taken a lot of this out of our school systems, the parent ed pieces, and this actually puts some of that back for parents and children.
And do you know how those are funded?
You know, I don't.
Okay.
I can get back to you or whatever, but I...
No, I've not seen that concept of federal funding, federal dollars. Okay, there we go. There's our answer. Okay, continue on with, I think we're on the adoption credit piece then.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And the adoption credit is very straightforward. It's allowing an adoption tax credit of $1,000, and that's kind of self-explanatory. If we want to encourage that, then this is a way to encourage that. And that runs us through most of the bill. Mary Ellen?
Maybe we should have testify.
Representative Rood.
So is the adoption credit, and forgive my Ian, is it for the person, the family who is adopting, or is it for the woman who's relinquishing a child?
I'm sorry, what was it?
The adoption credit. Who's getting it?
I think the idea is that it's to cover the expenses that you
incur.
It's a family, yes. Okay. Is that correct? I'm sorry,
yes.
President Trimble.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Houston and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I am the policy director for the Minnesota Catholic Conference. The Minnesota Catholic Conference is the public policy voice of the Catholic Church in Minnesota. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 2640, Representative Otranda's bill, of course, providing information, resources, and support to pregnant women. Tools necessary to increase the likelihood that women will have healthy pregnancies, healthy babies, and healthier lives. Catholic Church will teach and promote the culture of life by supporting policies and programs that encourage childbirth and adoption, and by addressing poverty, providing health care, and offering other assistance to pregnant women, children, and families. The Pregnant Women and Parent Support Act supports women by ensuring that insurance companies do not deny pregnant women prenatal and postnatal health care, increasing funding for the WIC nutrition program, requiring medical practitioners to provide additional detailed information about the reliability of the alpha fetal protein test used in diagnosing prenatal conditions, providing parenting skills education in maternity group homes, and increasing access to adoption referral information. While this act helps all pregnant women, it offers specific support for college-aged women. In addition to the points I outlined a moment ago, the act also provides grants to public and private post-secondary institutions to offer counseling and on-campus child care services to pregnant women. Many pregnant women believe that they do not have the support services or economic resources to raise a child and attend school. By increasing access to affordable on-campus child care and providing counseling support services to students, women will be able to continue their education, achieve their career goals, and create greater opportunities for themselves and their children. In order to build the common good here in Minnesota, we must support pregnant women, children, and families. Please support House File 2640. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, members? And I would just note, as we're going through the bill, and I think it's important that the witness raises, that there is, you know, also in this money, additional funding for the WIC program and for domestic abuse battered women, essentially, as well. And that wasn't something that was hit upon, but just to highlight that point. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Chairman Thiessen, and members of Hubson, and members of I just wanted to comment on the overall bill and the necessity for it and the passion that I have for this legislation. Over 20 years ago, working with Campaign for Human Development through the Catholic Church down in rural Greater Minnesota, I counseled and I tried to assist young women in their decisions to carry their baby to full term and adoption services at that time. And of course, over the course of many years, here I am again. At home, in the grocery store, where oftentimes, you know, representatives were touched by folks. And again, I've had just this last year, a young woman, a mother, 40-some years old, come to me about her daughter who is pregnant as a senior in high school and who has a great career ahead of her in college and had scholarships waiting for her. But, of course, she told Mom and Dad that she is expecting. And they are torn And again, you can imagine, I mean, what will we do? And these are, again, good, like myself, good old Catholics down there in, you know, greater Minnesota. And but this is, yes, they are. Yes, they are. But what a decision to be faced with still in this day and age. And I really, you know, again, had to go back to what was available and is it enough? And I don't, there isn't, it's just not enough. We don't have enough to, you know, I can't say go to the priest. Go here. Go. We need to have a support system for young women to continue to carry their baby, to have a family, to have an education, to be able to continue to go to school and take advantage of the scholarship. But here's what happens. The baby is born, and the mother, the grandmother, and grandfather are raising the child. And, you know, I just don't know if I could do that. And I do think that there ought to be some services, more services available for that family, for that grandchild. Thank you.
Representative Tremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we put this together, I did a press release, and I got an email a few months later, and this young girl, she was 17, emailed me that she now had an option in having an abortion, but she didn't know all the options. And she read it in the paper that this was a bill that we were doing. So I know that we've done a lot, but obviously we've not done enough. And now she has a one-year-old baby, and she's in school, in college, and she's doing great. But that, for me, said that we were doing something and a lot, but we need more. In, by reading a little media expert, so to speak. So that sort of solidified that we were doing the right thing.
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, you know, this is an excellent set of goals. I was reading the two-sided sheet here on the Pregnant Women and Parent Support Act, and all of these things are things we want as a state and as groups to do. And as somebody who worked with the Catholic Church for many years, I'm intimately aware of where the Catholic Church is on this. So, I mean, these are important goals. The question sometimes comes, how much of this is the state's responsibility? How much of this is the rest of society's responsibility? For example, the question might come back, what is the Minnesota Catholic Conference, for example, doing to meet these needs as a faith community? And I know that they are in certain ways, but this isn't exclusively something that's the state's responsibility and then nobody else's. And while I agree we need to offer more of these kinds of services, it's a community taking care of these situations and not only state funding, not only more welfare spending, frankly, in some cases, but how are we building up values in our young people? How are we educating people about choices and consequences and the value of life, frankly? So I applaud you for taking this approach. There may be some wrestling among some of us about whose ultimate responsibility is to do these things. And I think we have to acknowledge it's not just the state's job. There are many other factors. Many other organizations, frankly, are already doing a lot of this good work, and we need to try to work with them so that we have not so much overlap or blaming going on about whose responsibility this is to take care of it, but that we work together and not duplicate or replicate.
Any of the representatives of the council?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. My father always said if we did more with the churches, we wouldn't have to have the big bills we had for the state to pick up. So I think we're all looking for all of us to take care of this, and we need to work together and not criticize each other.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Otremba, thank you for this show, and I look forward to working with you as it moves forward. You know, as we're confessing our faith, I'm Buzzley, Catholic myself, and actually the social justice teachings that I was exposed to have a lot to do with what drive me. But I do want to just point out one thing, and hope we can work more on this, the section about the parenting support grant. Something that I see in my clinic, and we've had a lot of discussion today about women, I really wish we'd start bringing in the men. And there was a wonderful news program last week that featured, I think it was in Representative Walker's district, a parenting mentoring program, very successful. And it encourages actually couples to get married, I believe. But it talks about the importance of kind of a family structure, and you can have different ideas about what that family might look like. But I'll tell you, I see a lot of young women who have five different babies by five different men, and the men are nowhere to be found, and we really need to start having that discussion. So I just want to make that point, and then I'll look forward to working with you on it.
Mr. Chair, in my licensure for parents, I always make sure that the men are there, at least. But you know, it goes the other way too. A lot of times, there's men there, and not the women. You know, there's a lot of men raising their own.
Representative,
I just had one comment too to Representative Gottwald about the state getting involved, and of course, we all are in the same boat here, and. We talk about positive alternatives, which is a program that was brought to us. And this is also a program that we're bringing, in relation to that. So it's about the state, it's about the Catholics, it's about Lutheran social services, it's about adoption, it's about parenting, it's about all of those things. It's about beginning in the early stages in your family with your children. It's all of those things. And so this is a good bill, and this does bring into light the WIC program, which had been cut. Funding had been cut to those folks. So it's an economic, it's a moral issue. It's something that going forward that I think we ought to really take a close look at and implement this idea so that we can keep our families together and we can educate our children.
Yeah, and about effective education as well, I would suggest. Are there other witnesses on this bill? I think, Ms. Coleman. And there's a letter in the packet as well, just for members from Planned Parenthood, supporting pieces of it and having a few questions on it as well. Thank you for coming today.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm always hanging around here somewhere. I just wanted to, I know this is an informational hearing and there were some questions on the insurance provisions of this and what potentially would be the implications of that. And so I just want to provide some clarity. In the employer market issue, I think there were some comments that was confused a little bit about one of the comments that was made. The federal HIPAA requirements do prevent insurers in the group market to have waiting periods or pre-existing for maternity. So people who have their coverage to an employer, and this is one of those small times that because it was the feds whose law it is, it applies whether you're fully insured or self-funded. There's not waiting periods for maternity. There is a difference in the individual market. And currently in the individual market, it's interesting, as I was reading through the bill, it talks about not being able to apply a pre-existing to maternity in the individual market. But how the individual market works in Minnesota, I know this committee has had a lot of conversations about this, but currently there's underwriting in the individual market. And so if you were to apply for insurance and you were pregnant, the pre-existing is moot. You just won't be allowed onto the plan at all. So the pre-existing issue under current laws is almost moot. There is, for the most part, in individual policies, a one-year waiting period for maternity. And so this would get rid of that one-year waiting period. And so if you were to apply for insurance, you were not pregnant but soon became pregnant, that one-year waiting period would go away. Now, the current policies are priced in a way that considers that one-year waiting period. So this would have an impact on costs in the individual market. We haven't run the numbers on exactly what that would be. But just so to understand, in the larger market,
You know, maternity is 20-25% of all healthcare dollars. So and we've had that discussion here of both the cost of maternity, and so that is real. I do also want to point out that EMSA is a bit of a hybrid between an individual policy and a group policy. And on EMSA currently, the federal requirements of not having a pre-existing do not apply to EMSA. And EMSA actually does allow pre-existing for maternity. There are some conditions EMSA does not allow pre-existing, pregnancy is one of them. And so I think that you could, from a policy standpoint, have a situation where somebody's been denied coverage on an individual policy because they're pregnant and they have to have a waiting period on MSAT. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure what those people do currently. But again, if that were to, the pre-existing, this would go away for MSA as well, you know, that would impact the losses of MSA and how we fund MSA. That would fall to the small employer. So we would be happy to go back and do some number crunching to find out what the impact. But the initial reaction is this would have an impact on the cost for the individual market. And again, the idea with insurance is spreading the risk to get across everybody. You would hope that people, and this committee has done a lot to try to make healthcare more affordable. Ideally, people would have the insurance before they become pregnant, and then this doesn't become an issue. So if there's any question, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Okay, just to clarify then, this is not an issue in the group market because it's federal law covers it.
Correct.
And we're kind of using pre-existing and waiting period interchangeably a little bit, it sounds like. I mean, is it a pre-existing condition so you can't get insurance?
Well, I think pre-existing implies that an individual is accepted, that they're accepted to have the insurance, and then if they've had a lapse in coverage, certain conditions cannot be covered for a certain amount of time would be pre-existing. In this case, if you applied for insurance in Minnesota and you were pregnant, you would just be denied coverage altogether. So I think the intent may have been that maternity can't be an underwriting criteria, perhaps was more the intent, but as it's written, what it really, the pre-existing condition is a moot issue because you wouldn't be accepted onto the policy if you were pregnant. So the one-year waiting period is relevant. Most policies have a one-year waiting period, and this would no longer allow that.
Okay. Mr. Griffin, you want to?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm appearing today on behalf of Preferred One. And Mr. Chairman, members, I won't belabor what Representative, I almost insulted my colleague, what Ms. Coleman said. Just a small joke there, an epithet one, Mr. Chairman. But I do want to just caution the committee as you move forward. Preferred One just moved into the individual market last year. And this is a very, very volatile market, and particularly in the area of pregnancy and newborns. And my plan just asked me to talk a little bit about what the dollars are. Just to give you a personalized example, I'm on a policy for my family, which is an individual policy with a $5,000 deductible, and it runs about $385 a month, so a little over $4,000 a year. The average pregnancy on our plan, as we pay out, is $6,000 a year. $6,000 an episode. So you can see that if you are trying to price this product and somebody's coming on just because of a pregnancy, you can't price it high enough, particularly if you look at not just the normal outcome, which is that $6,000 with a good pregnancy, but the bad episode that we had literally last year, Preferred One, where we had a preemie that ran into multiple surgeries to children and over $3 million worth of costs. And those are the kinds of things that when you're trying to balance risk, you really need to be aware of. So our caution to the committee is that as you look at this legislation, we think Representative Otermba and the authors, and we know the committee, are all headed towards the same direction. We're hopeful that before we try and move away from having underwriting ability and having pre-existing conditions, that we move towards this era of making sure that everybody has coverage, and that we think that's the most important thing that you need to keep in mind as you make these decisions.
Thanks. Representative Gallo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Phil, and maybe some others here too could explain what happens. Young woman is pregnant, unable to obtain coverage, won't be accepted for coverage in most cases if they're already pregnant or they're pre-exed. So, and these costs are not being now accrued to these individual policies, but would be under this legislation. What's happening to those people right now? Where do they end up going? Are they going to the nonprofit agencies? Are they going to where do they end up going for care?
Ms. Kaufman, whoever.
I think it highlights a problem that we do have to address and why it's so important everybody has insurance. Unfortunately, it goes to uncompensated care. But the problem is, it's easier if you go to a hospital and you're going to get coverage for that. Our concern is, and why we were before this committee a couple weeks ago saying why we were concerned about offering products without maternity, is many of those people will go without their prenatal visit and just go to the hospital for the delivery, which will be uncompensated care, and without the prenatal visit, ultimately more expensive. So, absolutely, we have to balance the cost of the insurance, but we need other ways to make sure that coverage is more affordable so we don't have that circumstance. Absolutely.
Rosenblatt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Griffin, I just wanted to make sure I understood the numbers you were throwing out. Your example was a $385 a month policy with a $5,000 deductible, and then you mentioned that the maternity cost would be $6,000. Is that $6,000 on top of the $5,000 that they would have to pay as that initial deductible, so it's really $11,000 total? Or would it be, and then they'd pay, above the deductible, I assume usually it's an 80-20 plan, so they'd pay another couple hundred, or is it really $6,000 is total cost, prenatal, delivery, with an average pregnancy?
Mr. Griffin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wappler, the $6,000 figure is Preferred One's number. They just literally sent it to me about 10 minutes ago. That is the average cost for the prenatal care and the delivery and the post-delivery care, inpatient and the first couple of well-baby visits. So that's the package care that we negotiate. The numbers that I was talking about were just my own personal, what it costs for a policy. If you're buying an individual policy for a family of four with a $5,000 deductible, that's the monthly payment. And I'm trying to relate those two together to say that one costs $6,000 in care for a normal delivery. If you're trying to price this and your premium is only $4,000-something, it's just showing what the numbers are in terms of somebody coming in and buying a policy just to get that prenatal care taken care of. The insurance company takes a bath on it, and that's in the good case.
Just to follow up, then, for me to understand, though, if somebody were to have a $5,000 deductible policy, they would typically, in a normal pregnancy, have $1,000 of insurance coverage, and they'd pick up the first $5,000 on a normal delivery. Is that correct?
Mr. Griffin.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to say typical of anything. That's why I was giving you a specific example of my policy and what I'm paying. The delivery charges, the cost that's going to be negotiated with the individual providers, the tiering of different systems are going to make that different for everybody. So I don't want to give any broad example. But in the case of my policy, yes, if I had that normal delivery and that's what was paid and the negotiated rate was, in this example, Park Nicollet Clinic, which I can pull up their website right on my computer, which I've been looking at, they're just a little over $6,900 on their listing.
Representative Trumbull.
Mr. Chair, that's part of the reason that this bill is here, because they are having abortions because they don't have health care. And so that's the dilemma that's in this, this committee and in this bill. So.
Well, thank you for coming down and explaining that.
Certain members, thank you.
Any further questions or discussion? Representative Trumbull, did you have anything you wanted to?
Okay.
Well, thank you for everybody for the questions and for going through this. And we're meeting next same time next week to on a couple of other bills. Which,
well, Mr. Chair, yeah. I guess I should have thanked everybody for helping me out.
Okay.
And I look forward to everybody giving me input.
All right. So we're adjourned. Thank you, members.